This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Futuro.
I was so happy on that September 11th, 20 years ago. I remember it was a slow morning that morning because that day for CNN, I was going to have a day off. I was going to work that night. I was going to be able to be with my kids. I could take them to school on their first day. And I even woke up early enough to go to the gym super early. I was walking back from the gym that morning and I had my Walkman on. Yes, a Walkman. I was listening to the radio, El Vacilón de la Mañana. It's a raunchy kind of morning show, shock jocks in Spanish. And a caller calls into the radio show and she's totally freaked out. She's screaming. She's saying that a plane has crashed into a tower at the World Trade Center. And the jockeys, the DJs, they're just like, yeah, yucking it up. Like, sure, uh-huh. And then they said, oh, my God, it's true. They heard the sirens in the background. I ran back to my apartment, ran up 5 flights of stairs. CNN had already called, and I was to go downtown to get as close as I could to the World Trade Center. I got on the subway, and it was inside the subway with a bunch of other scared New Yorkers that we realized that a second plane had hit.
Just moments ago, so maybe 18 minutes after the first impact, the second tower was impacted with what appeared to be another passenger plane.
I got out of the subway or someplace around 23rd Street, and I started walking downtown, and waves of people were already pushing their way uptown away from the World Trade Center, and their faces were filled with trauma. Cars basically had stopped. There was no movement, no traffic, nowhere to go. Their doors were open. And their car radios were tuned into the same radio station. It was a news station echoing through the streets.
But they're obviously going to quit while they're ahead.
That's when suddenly I saw the tower fall, the first one.
Oh, my God, the building fell. Are you there? The building just fell.
I knew. I started screaming.
Oh, my God, the south building just crumbled from the top. Oh, my God.
CNN had told me to get to St. Vincent's Medical Center. That was just north of what would now be known as Ground Zero. I gathered outside of that hospital with the New York Press Corps, and there was a sea of green and white coming out of the hospital doors. All of the nurses and doctors in their scrubs and white sheets put over chairs, so that they were ready to receive all of the wounded, all of the survivors. And no one came. There are a lot of questions about, you know, so where were you on September 11th? Where were you when it happened? What do you remember? It's been 20 years, but that time hasn't dulled my memory. My home was under attack that day, and I'll never, ever forget. From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, on the 20th anniversary of September 11th, how that one catastrophic day impacted immigration for decades to come. One thing that we all immediately knew on September 11th, 20 years ago, was that this event was going to resonate across time and borders. Almost 3,000 people from more than 90 countries died on that day. Thousands more are dealing with lasting injuries, depression, and, like me, PTSD, including a lot of first responders, the Ground Zero cleanup workers, many of them who were undocumented, and people from the community. But even before those physical and mental traumas really manifested in full, very quickly a new political reality emerged from fear in that moment. People found themselves willing to grant the government control over just about anything that could be tied back to national security, believing that was the way to keep Americans safe from terrorism. And soon after that, the panic over keeping the country safe evolved into an ugly, ongoing debate over, yes, immigration once again. Politicians and journalists call for the tightening of U.S. borders, toughening up our immigration system at large, and keeping people out.
The public understands that strict enforcement of immigration laws is a very helpful way of stopping and reducing the terrorist threat.
And you cannot put those two things in separate boxes and deal with immigration over here and border security over here.
I want the borders under our control, and I don't see anything either peculiar about that or unseemly or insensitive.
Newsrooms were under pressure to defer to pro-U.S. narratives. And if you questioned any of this, well, that made you an unpatriotic American. A total crackdown on refugees and migrants would soon be underway. And this approach would inform the U.S. government's next major moves, including the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, which did not exist before September 11th. It also led to the dismantling of the INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and replacing it with several new agencies, including ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. But to really understand just how much 9/11 changed the entire narrative around immigration in the United States, we've got to go back a bit further. Our producer, Alejandra Salazar, is going to take it from here.
The first year of the new millennium was one for the history books. After surviving the Y2K computer scare, we had the Sydney Summer Olympics.
More than 10,000 athletes. The Olympic Games have come down under.
And the premiere of the hit reality series Survivor. The first crew to live on the International Space Station.
One, liftoff of the Soyuz rocket, beginning the first expedition to the International Space Station.
And also in 2000, a new U.S. Census. The National Survey determined that more than 281 million people lived in this country, the largest number in its history up to that point. And in November, following a historically close and contentious election...
Stand by. CNN right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column. This no longer is a victory for Vice President Gore.
Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States.
37 days after Americans went to the polls, and now we have a winner. Now it can be said, President-elect Bush.
Bush was elected with 35% of the Latino vote, the highest Latinx turnout for a Republican since Ronald Reagan in 1984. And this was pretty significant. The Latino population had expanded by more than 50% over the last decade to more than 35 million people. Latinos represented a rapidly growing voter bloc that couldn't be easily ignored anymore. Capitalizing on this political moment, the Bush administration introduced an agenda that indicated pro-immigration reform was in the works, especially to help and benefit Mexicans. As the former governor of Texas, Bush had developed a friendly relationship with then-Mexican President Vicente Fox that continued into his presidency.
Presidente, I want you to know that we consider you a friend of Mexico, a friend of Mexican people, and a friend of mine.
In February 2001, a joint U.S.-Mexico panel released recommendations for future immigration policy. including streamlining the process for Mexicans to attain visas and legal status in the U.S.
We exchanged ideas about safe and orderly migration, a policy that respects individuals on both sides of the border.
And according to reports from July 2001, the White House was even considering offering permanent residency to undocumented Mexicans in the U.S. This move would have dramatically changed the lives of more than 3 million people in this country. That summer, Congress was deliberating several bills to offer protections and citizenship opportunities to immigrant farm workers. But come fall, the bills were shelved. 9/11 had ushered in a new political atmosphere where pro-immigrant legislation just didn't stand a chance. Instead, issues like securing borders and gathering intelligence became top priorities.
May I have your terminal,
for example, the Transportation Security Administration was created, TSA. It also came with new airport screening rules. That's why you have to take off your shoes at security or X-ray all your electronics. The U.S. Patriot Act was passed only 45 days after the attacks. It gave the government power to monitor your phone records and your internet use and access your personal records like individual finances. This was all done in the name of fighting terrorism. 9/11 also normalized anti-immigrant attitudes on a national scale. The 19 hijackers behind 9/11 were all from Middle Eastern countries, and several arrived in the U.S. well before the attacks. The idea that people born outside of this country could become its biggest threat turned into a mainstream policy priority almost overnight.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives...
Remember Donald Trump's Muslim ban just 4 years ago?
What the hell is going on?
One of the most obvious precedents for it was the Bush administration's National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, NSEERS for short. It was established within a year of 9/11.
It was a special registration program for certain individuals that came from countries that had a historic tie to terrorism. We just had to give closer scrutiny to those individuals to make sure they had legitimate travel to the United States.
For nearly a decade, non-citizens entering the U.S. had to register with the federal government. That meant giving their fingerprints, photos, and submitting to interrogation. They were monitored by immigration officials and tracked to make sure they left the country as intended. Overstaying their visas meant arrests, fines, and deportations. All men 16 years and older from a list of 25 countries were forced to participate in the NSEERS program. 24 of those countries were majority Muslim, including Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, the four countries that the 9/11 hijackers were from. Over 80,000 men and boys were registered, and more than 13,000 were put in the pipeline for deportation. Now, this endeavor ultimately failed. The program didn't result in a single terrorism-related conviction, not one. NSEERS was suspended in 2011 and ended in 2016 under the Obama administration.
Obama's move comes only one day after Donald Trump appeared to reiterate his pledge to reinstate this very registry when answering a question from a reporter.
For the past 20 years, immigration and terrorism have been handled within the same federal organization. Not even a month after 9/11, the Bush administration created the Office of Homeland Security. It became a cabinet-level department a year later with the passage of the Homeland Security Act.
The Homeland Security Act of 2002 takes the next critical steps in defending our country. The continuing threat of terrorism, the threat of mass murder on our own soil, will be met with a unified, effective response. Dozens of agencies charged with Homeland Security will now be located within one...
DHS is huge, with 22 agencies under its purview, and its responsibilities are vast. DHS is in charge of national cybersecurity, the Coast Guard, the Secret Service, and the Countering Weapons of Mass Destruction Office, just to name a few. But this is also the same department that processes and polices new immigrants to the United States. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a.k.a. ICE, didn't exist until 2002. It's also a part of DHS. The agency's responsibilities include enforcing border security, regulating immigration, and removing, quote, criminal non-citizens from the United States. In the name of national security, immigrants would be formally recorded, vetted, tracked, detained, held in legal limbo for decades, and subject to brutality and mistreatment at the hands of enforcement officers. This isn't to say that immigration enforcement wasn't happening before 9/11. But with all these new security policies and agencies, immigrants became obvious mainstream targets.
ICE will attack thousands of families separating children from parents.
Passionate protesters today in Chicago joined those in cities around the nation.
ICE has got to go!
ICE has only become more powerful over the years, with record-level detainments and deportations over the past decade under the Obama and Trump administrations.
You know, let's just remember that the largest deportation happened under President Obama. There are many critics call him the deporter-in-chief, and that was something like 400,000. So when you're talking about millions here, it is unprecedented.
Several loud and angry protests were held across the country today over President Trump's decision to start immigration raids tomorrow.
And the entire reason for its existence is based on a single idea, that immigrants pose an ongoing threat to this country. An idea that was crystallized after 9/11 and that we're still grappling with to this day.
Coming up on Latino USA, more on the repercussions of the 9/11 attacks on immigrant communities. And we learn about Real ID, a seemingly innocuous federal legislation that risks pushing hundreds of thousands of undocumented drivers into a colliding path with ICE. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between, and they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, we're back. Before the break, we heard about the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. But that was just the beginning. The policies which followed under the guise of securing the nation would infiltrate numerous aspects of local and federal governance, including states' departments of motor vehicles. But at the other end of the new quote-unquote anti-terrorism policies, the people most affected would once again be immigrant families. So how did September 11th pave the way for something known as the Real ID? Latino USA producer Julieta Martinelli is going to pick up the story from here.
In August 2008, Sulema, my mom, received a letter in the mail. I was living a few blocks away at the time, and she called me immediately.
My friend Chuy had got a letter before me. So I knew that it might happen to me, too.
The letter came from the Department of Driver Services in Georgia, where we had lived since 1997, when my mom, my older brother, and I immigrated from Argentina. We knew immediately it was bad news. The letter said that her license was about to expire. Georgia, at the time, granted driver's licenses for 10 years. My mom had gotten hers in 98 when she still had a tourist visa, just months after arriving. The letter said in order to renew it, she would need to go to the DMV and provide documents proving that she was living legally in the U.S.
It was like the end of the world because I knew that there was no way I could provide that number.
The problem was, for nearly 11 years, we've lived in the U.S. undocumented.
You feel like the world is opening on your feet. Because, you know, from there on, things were going to be different. And I felt really very bad.
Now, being undocumented affected our daily lives in endless ways. We couldn't travel. We hadn't seen our family in years. And just a couple years earlier, my mom had gotten laid off. I couldn't even go to college at the time, but I had managed to get hired as an intern at a Spanish language newspaper, and there I had been trained to be a reporter. I was actually working two jobs, at the newspaper during the day, and when I got off, I would work until 4 a.m. as a shift manager at a nearby Taco Bell. Working with questionable paperwork meant you had to take what was available. Often your bosses knew that too, and your wages reflected that. But my mom being able to drive in suburban Georgia was huge and necessary. There was just one train line to Atlanta, which required a 20-minute drive to the station from our house, and a spotty at best public bus system. A driver's license meant that she could drive to clean houses daily, that she wouldn't need to work for someone else, that she could go and get groceries, to the park on the weekends. Think of how often you show your ID in your daily life. To travel, to walk into a bar, even to buy cough syrup at the pharmacy. But more importantly, it meant she could register her car. She could get insurance. She was a lifeline for our family.
It was a risk that we had to run. There was no other way. If not, it was like put your life in a permanent stop if you couldn't drive. We decided to go on because we came to this country to work. To improve.
Like my mom, non-citizen drivers all over the state with licenses set to expire that year received similar letters. In 2003, Georgia had started to verify the legal status of all applicants by requiring immigration paperwork and running it through various databases. That's why my brother and I had never been able to apply for a license. We were just too young before the cutoff. But my mom was one of the last holdouts, people who had received their driver's licenses before the state's more stringent policies. Plus, Georgia was streamlining. On January 1st, 2008, the Georgia Department of Driver Services officially began using a program called SAVE. It was used to confirm people's identities and lawful presence in the country in order to grant driver's licenses. SAVE was a program created by USCIS, that's the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the agency that administers the country's naturalization and immigration system. It, too, lives under the purview of the overreaching Department of Homeland Security. That was supposed to make things faster and more accurate. Instead of running names and socials through several databases, this was the future, all in one. Around the same time, the Georgia legislature began considering a bill to make driving while unlicensed a felony. A felony, any felony, would later need to be disclosed to USCIS if an opportunity ever arose to legalize status.
It was scary. It was really scary. And we were running, like playing hide and seek. That was it. With the police, with the immigration things, it was a very hard time.
By the end of 2008, My mom was on her first of many years driving unlicensed, and so was I. But neither of us realized just how tied what was happening in our present was to an event that had shaken the whole nation nearly a decade earlier. This wasn't just Georgia being Georgia. It was happening across the nation. But how was life before 9/11 changed it completely? Things weren't all that better. There were thousands of undocumented people like me and my family who were living in states that did not grant driver's licenses. Some of them traveled to states like Washington, North Carolina, or Tennessee, where proof of legal status was not necessary. There, you could get a driver's license and register your vehicle, so you had a valid tag. In other states, undocumented people had been able to access driver's licenses using other documents, sometimes borrowing a friend's address. In other places, like Virginia, the state allowed waivers that identified resident drivers as non-citizens, but still allowed them to legally drive. The American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, which represents the state agencies that issue licenses, had even begun urging Congress to issue uniform rules regarding the granting of licenses to undocumented people instead of leaving it to each state. And there were a lot of good reasons to do it.
More than 10 other states already allow it, and advocates say it would make the roads safer and raise millions of dollars in revenue.
It would be good for the state, good for the undocumented individuals who could get the licenses, good for safety, good for revenue, which is in a way the least important.
And some states were making progress. In the summer of 2001, the New York Times reported that the Hispanic liaison to the New York County government had asked the DMV to accept the individual taxpayer identification number, which is issued by the IRS, on applications for licenses. While undocumented people in places like New York City were close to finally being able to get legal IDs and driver's licenses, September 11 ended those conversations completely. Immediately after the terrorist attacks, as information trickled out slowly, the 24-hour news cycle was dominated by stories of the terrorists who had been able to do what they did because they had been able to obtain legal identifications.
And this terrorist attack did fly to Boston from Portland, Maine. And interestingly enough, they used New Jersey driver's license as identification.
16 of the 19 terrorists held valid driver's licenses or identification cards from states including Virginia and Florida. These documents had enabled them to board planes, open bank accounts, and rent apartments. The federal government was under mounting pressure to publicly address this, quote, vulnerability in the system.
The 9/11 Commission noted, all but one of the 9/11 Commission hijackers acquired some form of U.S. identification document, some by fraud. Acquisition of these forms of identification would have assisted them in boarding commercial flights, renting cars, and other necessary activities. That's the Commission report.
In the following 2 years, nearly every state with potential gaps took measures to toughen its rules. A traumatized nation needed some semblance of security, of control. And this was one of the things the government could actually tell citizens that they were trying to rein in. Initially, politicians began calling out for a national database so that policies mirrored each other state to state. But issuing of identification cards falls under state legislation, so the federal government could not take over and force a uniform set of guidelines. That Congress, the Real ID Act of 2005 was passed with bipartisan support. It found a way to force states to update their laws by mandating that DMVs require proof of citizenship to grant Real ID driver's licenses and ID cards, among other measures. Applicants would have to prove their legal status by showing documents like a U.S. passport, a Social Security card, or even a green card. This was a huge blow to undocumented people because it meant the federal government has succeeded in forcing the hand of states that had at least been friendly and was empowering the states that hadn't, like Georgia, to restrict access even further.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Members of Congress have also taken up the issue. In February, a provision known as Real ID passed in the House of Representatives. It would impose federal standards on driver's licenses and also make it harder for emigres to seek asylum. It would also
Real IDs are simply identifications that have passed a, quote, higher level of security. People's data has been checked against a number of federal databases to house information about the applicants. The legislation made it so that the real IDs would eventually become mandatory for people who want to access federal facilities, board federally regulated airplanes, and enter nuclear power plants. Any state that did not comply with the minimum regulations could still provide driver's licenses to their residents, but by a set period of time when the law would go into effect, those citizens would be blocked from accessing these federally controlled areas. Of course, the one most people cared about was the ability to fly. I mean, imagine, you show up at the airport to spend Christmas with your family or maybe to attend a friend's wedding in another state. And a TSA agent tells you, oh, well, your driver's license is from New York, so you're not allowed to fly. This was really what forced all 50 states to start complying with real ID legislation. But it was hard and expensive. Although there was a lot of pushback from states who did not want the federal government to shape their laws, changes were imminent. And back home, something else was happening at the same time.
There were tons of police cars, like 30 or 40 police cars in a street, and then big buses picking up people from their cars and taking them into the bus to take them to the prison. And that was just because he didn't have a driver's license.
In 2009, the year after my mom began driving unlicensed, there was a new boogeyman. It was no longer just about dodging police cruisers that hid behind bushes or staked out drivers at the bottom of hills. It was the beginning of the roadblocks.
Remember mm-hmm. the roadblocks?
Yes, all the time. That was crazy. That time was so difficult. But the good thing that I remember is that our people got organized. We text each other, and we knew there was a roadblock over that area. So I called my husband and said, hey, don't go to that street because there is a roadblock.
287G was a new program, a collaboration between local police department and ICE. Anyone who was arrested and booked into a local jail that participated in the program would have their legal status checked immediately. If they were undocumented, they would be referred to ICE. And if ICE confirmed they were not here legally, they could be put into deportation proceedings. In Gwinnett County, where I grew up, the local sheriff joined 287G. It effectively granted his deputies the power of ICE agents. The county jail could detain immigrants on federal retainers.
A message that's being sent loud and clear in Gwinnett County. If you are in the country illegally and you commit a crime, you could be deported. The program called 287G was just approved, and it has people on both sides of the immigration debate sounding off.
So close was that partnership that the Gwinnett County Detention Center allowed ICE agents to install an office in there. That meant every second counted. When a loved one was arrested, everyone mobilized. You had to get the money immediately, have someone with a legal ID on call who could show up at the jail and bond the person out as quickly as possible. If you took too long, maybe because you didn't have thousands of dollars at your disposal, it could be too late. A traffic infraction like driving on an expired license could and often did get undocumented people deported. In fact, while ICE holds in Gwinnett peaked in 2012, a Mother Jones investigation found that still, between 2017 and July 2019, the primary charge for nearly half of the people held for ICE at the Gwinnett County Jail was for driving without a license or another minor traffic violation.
So it's much scary because we felt that was a never ending. It was any time close to where you were going to sleep, and then you received a message saying there is a blockage in such or that street. And I remember we just went to work and we didn't go to the store unless you really need it, because what you wanted to get is just get home.
It was so prevalent that eventually everyone in my household had been booked at the Gwinnett County Jail at least once.
I remember the first time you ever got pulled over, and I remember I cried.
No, that was awful. That was an awful day. That day was a morning that I went. I used to go to one client that I cleaned her house, but she was always asking me to iron for her. And I remember I was passing next to the lake and I was looking at the lake and I said, what, such a beautiful morning. And when I looked, I saw police stopping me because I was over speeding. I didn't realize it was 25 that area and it was 30. They told me, well, I'm sorry, ma'am, put your hands behind. And I felt so bad at that moment.
We were lucky, though. All of us were out in time. But not everyone in our community could say that.
Pueblo unido jamás será vencido!
Just last month, human rights groups came together to urge Georgia counties to end the program.
287G serves as deportation pipeline where thousands of immigrants and refugees are being deported, breaking families apart.
And opponents of 287G say the agreement causes mistrust between the community and local law enforcement.
Real ID, which began as a way to tighten ID laws, once coupled with other policies, actually opened the path for increased immigration enforcement and deportations in many places. It turned people into criminals. Moms, dads, tios. Now they all had records, their names were in the system, they'd all been in a cell. Any brush with the government was dangerous. I mean, that was the first thing I learned when we came to the U.S. Lay low, don't call attention to yourself. But Real ID pushed into the light many undocumented people who otherwise would have never had contact with police or DHS. It stopped people from applying for jobs, going to school, accessing needed resources, you name it. Something as innocuous as calling the police because you witnessed a crime became scary. Any contact with police could change your life. It made everyone unsafe. Nearly a decade after September 11, the canceling of driver's licenses and the decision of local police departments across the country to participate in 287G caused a perfect storm in communities like mine. People who lost their ability to work were at the same time faced with a number of growing raids and roadblocks. Often, on the way home from work, we would get phone calls. Police said it was all about public safety, but everyone knew they were out looking for us. It became like a game of chicken with really high stakes. That anxiety, in many ways, became a baseline. It's just how things were. The fear never really goes away. It just dulls.
See, you get used to the situation. You feel that everything is normal and until something bad happens. And then it's when it comes the end of the world for the family.
My older brother, after a number of arrests and exhausted from the constant risk, decided to go back to Argentina in 2014. My mom, who had experienced the pain of being away from her parents for over a decade, now had to learn to be away from her son and her only grandkids. My brother couldn't return to the U.S. My mom couldn't go to Argentina. It was yet another separation in our family. If 9/11 was an atomic bomb that caused so much pain and destruction on impact, what came after was the radiation that infested but couldn't be seen. The deadly repercussions that hit the unseen. The law, the persecution, the loss. There was no way to know when it would end, if it would end. Each day, the waves kept coming. And most of us just try to stay afloat. Gwinnett has two claims to fame. I always tell people that when they ask me where I'm from. It's where the Migos are from. And for years, it was the county with the most 287G ICE holds in the nation. It's been 16 years, and the national implementation of Real ID has repeatedly been delayed. The last time in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but it is set to finally go into effect in 2023. If you've flown recently, you've seen the signs. They're everywhere at the airport. At the same time, more states than ever now allow undocumented residents to apply for driver's licenses. The number is now at 16. That includes California, New York, Colorado, and most recently, Virginia. These states have found a way to comply with Real ID by granting documents that cannot be used for federal ID purposes, meaning once Real ID finally goes into effect, undocumented people will not be able to use their identification to do things like travel by plane, but they will still be able to drive safely in their state. Whether these changes, this legislation, this persecution was ever needed, whether it aided safety is up for debate. 2 decades later, states are still learning that it's better for public safety to allow undocumented people to drive legally.
No Guamor!
In other places, things move a little slower.
Hundreds of people from all walks of life, including young children, came out to downtown Atlanta to protest and denounce what they're calling were raids on the immigrant community over the last few weeks.
Georgia still does not grant licenses to people without legal status. Driving without a permit in the state can land you in jail for up to a year. In 2020, Sheriff Butch Conway decided not to run for re-election after nearly 2 decades at the helm of the Gwinnett County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Conway's protege was defeated by an opponent who ran on an anti-287G platform. That same year, Gwinnett ranked 4th in the entire country for the number of ICE detainer requests. On January 1, 2021, newly elected Sheriff Cable Taylor ended Gwinnett's 287G contract with ICE after more than a decade. Back in my home, we don't worry about that little plastic rectangle, a driver's license that so affected our life at one point. At least, not as much anymore. In 2017, I became a U.S. citizen. And the following year, I was able to petition for my mom. We drive in peace now. But the repercussions in our family are permanent. My brother's gone. My stepfather is at risk. At any time, the phone could ring and we'll need to be ready to rush to the local jail to help a relative or a friend. People can and are still persecuted for their legal status. And often, it still starts with a driver's license.
But I think that makes us more humans. It's like you become more empathetic to the situations of the people around you. If you see a neighbor or a friend that you know doesn't have a driver's license, you always tell them, call me if you need a drive, because now I am on the other side. And I remember when you first started, I remember you also running behind your friends because some of your friends went to prison and there you went to take them out. And the same thing happened to us.
That's what happens in our community. The system that could append the lives of our loved ones never rests. And that means neither do the rest of us.
Coming up on Latino USA, the immigration bill interrupted by September 11th. 2 decades later, thousands of undocumented immigrants and advocates continue to fight to keep it alive. That's after the break. Stay with us. No te vayas. Back. The attacks on September 11th brought a promising immigration bill that was making its way through Congress to a total and sudden halt. Its failure to pass in 2001 would then define the next 20 years of immigration activism for many in the country. Our producer, Victoria Estrada, is going to look at that story and takes it from here.
In the summer of 2001, Daniel Sueta had just graduated from high school. She wanted to go to college, but there was one problem. Dania was undocumented.
My counselor had basically told me that if I didn't have a lot of money saved up and I didn't have residency or citizenship or like an international student permit, my only option was to go to Mexico.
When Dania was 10 years old, she and her family entered the U.S. with tourist visas, but stayed and made a life in Chicago. Dania had good grades in high school, was captain of the swim team, but her academic and sports skills would be of little help. Undocumented, she not only didn't have access to most grants or scholarships to help pay for college, she was required to pay out-of-state prohibitive rates.
And so I actually ended up applying as an international student to several colleges, which then did require me to travel abroad, go to Mexico, apply as in the U.S. Embassy as an international student.
But her student visa was denied, and Tania was suddenly trapped outside the United States. Her family immediately started to organize to bring her back. They held rallies, friends wrote letters of support on her behalf, and they even reached out to Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. At the time, Durbin and Orrin Hatch from Utah were drafting a piece of legislation that could help other students in similar situations.
Yeah, it was this idea that undocumented students who had graduated in the U.S. didn't really have a path forward.
The bill had a very narrow scope. It would grant legal residency to undocumented high school graduates who had entered the U.S. as children. It just had a few requirements. Applicants needed to have been in the country for at least 5 years, have no criminal record that might make them inadmissible or deportable, and be a, quote, person of good moral character. The Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors, or DREAM Act, was considered to have wide bipartisan support, since the senators who sponsored it were both one of the most conservative and one of the most liberal in the Senate. Reports at the time said that there were anywhere from 50,000 to 75,000 children graduating from high school every year with no legal status. That meant up to 75,000 students for whom higher education was virtually denied.
That was the first time that I saw that statistic next to my name and sort of understood that there was a bigger problem than just me and my family who was scared, right?
More recent reports show that the number of undocumented high school graduates today is closer to 100,000 a year. With the direct help of Senator Durbin, Tania was able to get a humanitarian visa and return to the States. Then the senator's office asked her to be part of the campaign to support the one legislation that could completely change her life. By that point, Tania had come out publicly about her undocumented status, so she spoke about her personal story. But also,
part of my speech was saying, like, there must be something wrong if 60,000 undocumented students graduate every year and, like, don't have a chance to go to school. Like, it wasn't about even me anymore. It was like, if it's me and 60,000 other people, like, something else is going on that we're not resolving.
So when they asked her to, Tania didn't hesitate to testify before the Senate a few weeks later.
I think they saw it as a good example of, you know, someone who, like, fit the narrative, you know, had good grades, was president of the swim team, had to go to Mexico to figure all this out, and, like, was actually still trying to figure out where to go to school.
Teresa Lee, another undocumented high school graduate from Chicago who had originally inspired the DREAM Act, was also set to testify. The hearing was scheduled for September 12, 2001. Tania was supposed to fly to D.C. the day before. Spirits were high.
On September 11th, I remember I was supposed to be at O'Hare in, like, the early afternoon. I remember Gladysol from Senator Durbin's staff had checked in with me. She was the person that I was going to meet at the airport. And I woke up because my grandmother, who was at home with me, said that I had a call from Gladysol. And so she's the one who told me that she was at the airport at the moment and that there was something going on and that she actually didn't think that we were gonna be able to travel to DC and that most likely the congressional hearing was gonna be postponed. And that's when I, like, literally, like, woke up and turned on the TV and started seeing the images of the first plane.
It's 8:52 here in New York. We understand that there has been a plane crash on the southern tip of Manhattan. You're looking at the World Trade
Center. I just stayed at home and watched the news. I, you know, like everyone, I didn't know what was happening. I remember, like, all the planes were grounded, and I remember paying attention to that because I still had
a little bit of hope that I was going to travel to DC. So we were just waiting to see when the planes would be like ungrounded or like when that would be lifted. So there was that sense of like postponement and we're just like waiting for things to get back to normal.
Tanya would later realize that, after all, the hearing wasn't going to happen that week or that year. Her flight was never rescheduled, nor her testimony in support of the DREAM Act. While the DREAM Act kept coming back in the next years, the country had forever changed, and so had the debate around the bill. When it was reintroduced in 2003, it had new requirements. Applicants had to have entered the U.S. before their 16th birthday. There was no vote on the bill that year either, and in the next legislature, it was changed again, this time to adjust the status of the potential beneficiaries, from permanent residents to conditional permanent residents. The new version of the bill didn't make it to a vote on the floor. In 2007, the DREAM Act was introduced yet again, this time with the added requirement that applicants needed to be under 30 years old. Finally, a vote was scheduled, but the Bush White House came out against the bill, saying that it created loopholes that would legalize undocumented immigrants convicted of multiple misdemeanors and even felonies. Instead, the administration argued that what was needed was comprehensive immigration reform that included strong border and interior enforcement. The bill failed by less than 10 votes. Detractors said they were not going to consider any piece of legislation that, quote, rewarded immigrant lawbreakers. Still, the immigration movement was garnering national momentum. In 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president, he identified immigration reform as a priority.
The American people need us to put an end to the petty partisanship that passes for politics in Washington. And they need us to enact comprehensive immigration reform once and for all. They need not, we can't wait 20 years from now to do it. We can't wait 10 years from now to do it. We need to do it by the end of my first term as president of the United States of America.
As we know, Obama made it to the White House, but no reforms followed.
And I think that's when I started getting really disappointed and a little bit more jaded about the politics because, you know, sort of expected it under Bush and under a Republican, but not so much under a Democrat.
Tanya says she developed something she calls Obama trauma.
I remember just having a lot of hope that that was going to impact my parents in particular and my own situation. Every time it was bad, like every time I remember just watching him and him being like, yes, we need immigration reform, but first, you know, we need the enforcement and but first we need to do this. And so I started getting really tired of it.
With no immigration reform nor DREAM Act available, Tanya had managed to enter the University of Illinois at Chicago only with a private scholarship for her first year. And after that,
we had talked to some of the counselors who had, you know, sort of told us how to click on the right boxes so that, you know, I wasn't claiming that I was a citizen, but I also wouldn't be charged as an international student.
She began working in a radio station and after graduating, mentoring students as well. She continued to organize in favor of immigrants. And in 2009, something happened that would push her activism further.
One of my students had gotten pulled over by local Chicago police. They had turned him over to immigration enforcement and was actually in deportation proceedings and showed me that he was wearing an ankle monitor.
The student was Rigo Padilla. In a matter of weeks, Tanya, Rigo, and Ray Wences, another emerging activist, founded the Immigrant Youth Justice League to fight Rigo's deportation. On March 10th of 2010, they organized the first coming out rally for undocumented immigrants in Chicago. It was part of a much larger movement that was spreading quickly. In January, four students had started the Trail of Dreams March, a 1,500-mile, four-month walk to support the DREAM Act.
We started back in Miami. We're going all the way to Washington, D.C. To demand for President Obama to stop the separation of families and stop the deportation of young students.
And on May 17th,
moments ago, protesters stirring things up in downtown Tucson at this hour. This is a live picture just outside Senator John McCain's office.
Tanya and four other undocumented youths held a sit-in at the Tucson offices of Senator John McCain. urging him to support the DREAM Act.
I saw this photo going around where five undocumented students had done a sit-in at McCain's office.
This is Julio Salgado.
I am an artist. I'm an artist who happens to be undocumented and queer.
He was shocked when he saw what Tania and the others were daring to do.
And I was like, oh my God, what are they doing? They're going to get arrested. They're going to get deported.
A few years earlier, Julio, who's from California, had his own start in advocacy, creating a support group for undocumented students in college.
I remember they have like a welcoming week for students, and we set up our table and we were very strategic and being like, okay, we should put that we are a group for AB 540 students, and other AB 540 students will know what that means, right?
AB 540 was a state law that went into effect about a month after 9/11. It let undocumented students pay in-state tuition at California's public colleges and universities. It was a progressive policy that allowed Julio and many others to continue their education. Only students in nine other states with similar laws had the privilege at the time.
But it was super secretive. It wasn't, there was no undocumented and afraid. None of that. It was like, you know, at that time I'm from a generation of undocumented and very afraid.
But Tania's and others' activism emboldened him.
I was like, all right, well, I'm not an organizer. You know, I don't do that. But I'm like, what can I do to add to this movement, right? And so, you know, like I started making images.
One of the first images he produced was a figure with a graduating cap and gown being taken away by two police officers as she shouts, I exist.
For me, it was very important to document those specific interventions from undocumented immigrants because I felt that it was a historic moment. And I was like, we need to make sure that this gets documented and it gets documented by us.
For so long, they had lived trying to go unnoticed, but that was over. Other acts of civil disobedience followed. Undocumented activists held sit-ins in Washington, D.C. and hunger strikes in Los Angeles. On December 18th of 2010, the House of Representatives passed a new version of the DREAM Act. This time, the bill's requirement had extended to include also a medical examination and a background check. Just before the vote, Senator Lindsey Graham took to the floor to say to those who had come to his office to protest that they were wasting their time.
We're not going to pass the DREAM Act or any other legalization program until we secure our borders.
36 Republicans and 5 Democrats voted against the bill. With only 55 votes in favor, it didn't have a filibuster-proof majority. After coming so close and seeing it fail yet again, Tania felt depleted.
At this point, I feel like I was also kind of used to things like this happening. Like, yeah, there was definitely like a feeling of like, well, of course. Like, of course it doesn't happen again.
The thing was, the argument Republicans had used against the DREAM Act, that no immigration bill could be passed until borders were secure, had also been used by Democrats trying to push for immigration reform. In the summer of 2009, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer outlined a framework for immigration reform that included this principle.
Any immigration solution must recognize that we must do as much as we can to gain control of our borders as soon as possible.
Other points included a biometric-based employment verification system and having all undocumented immigrants in the country register and submit to a, quote, rigorous process to earn their path to citizenship, or else face deportation. Although Schumer did vote in favor of the 2010 DREAM Act, the principles he laid out for immigration reform just a year before had the same basis as of those who objected to the bill. That immigrants were guilty until proven innocent. After that narrow loss, the bill would continue to go through different versions, winning and losing support as politics changed. One of its original sponsors in 2001 did not vote for the DREAM Act in 2010, and Senator Lindsey Graham, who spoke against it in 2010, would later become a co-sponsor of the DREAM Act.
At every single cycle of elections, we were becoming a political game piece, right? Like, I have my dreamer here who's going to share their story. And you start, you're like, I don't believe you anymore.
In the summer of 2012, the last year of his first term and seeking re-election, President Obama made an announcement.
This morning, Secretary Napolitano announced new actions my administration will take to mend our nation's immigration policy, to make it more fair, more efficient, and more just, specifically for certain young people, sometimes called dreamers.
With no immigration reform after 4 years in the White House, Obama used his executive power to create the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. The policy allowed undocumented immigrants who had been brought to the U.S. as children to request deferred action from deportation and get a work permit. They needed a record free of felonies or serious misdemeanors, and they had to reapply to the program every 2 years. DACA didn't offer a path to citizenship. It just stopped deportation. It was never meant to be a long-term fix.
It was a bittersweet moment for a lot of us. It wasn't the Dream Act. It didn't include our parents. And I remember not wanting to apply to DACA.
It seemed like a defeat. But eventually he did apply and got into the program. He's still a part of it. When Donald Trump was elected, he tried to end the program, but was blocked by the courts. Nevertheless, just a few months ago, DACA was ruled unconstitutional by a federal judge in Texas. And for now, all new applications have been suspended.
It's a constant, is it going to go away? Because I'm able now to legally work in this country, I am very lucky to have, insurance through my job. That could go away at any minute if this shenanigans continue, right? And so it's a constant, like, you should be thankful, but at the same time, like, here's some a little stress for you, right?
It's kind of ridiculous that we've been talking about passing something for 20 years at this point, and that's the only thing that's been able to move forward. And that, like, at the same time, has been so fickle.
And that is frustrating for somebody who's been doing this for like almost 20 years. I just made an image yesterday. I put an image out that said, save the DACA youth. And in the bottom, I'm like, ma'am, I'm 37. You know, like,
this touched on something that Tanya sees as a problem with the original push for the DREAM Act.
Because we wanted to make a point, like, we were very disciplined because we felt like we have to shape our stories in a way that fit this strategy of moving forward the bill. I think over the years has also become this ugly thing that in policy means that, like, people who don't fit that narrative, including our parents, get left out of, like, any sort of negotiations or considerations.
They needed to be that perfect immigrant, someone innocent who had been brought to the U.S. as a child, got good grades, never made mistakes that ended up in criminal convictions, spoke English and wanted to go to college or the army. Tanya and other activists began to question that narrative.
I don't think that paints a realistic picture of anyone. I mean, I think, like, you know, first of all, there is the question of the criminal justice system. Over the last several years in particular, there's been a huge, like, Black-led movement that has exposed all of the cracks in a very mass way of the criminal justice system and how it targets people of color. And I think, like, if we believe that's true, then by definition, whenever we exclude immigrants who have any sort of criminal record from bills like the DREAM Act or from immigration reform, we're buying into the things that the criminal justice system says.
That's why, in a way, the failing of the DREAM Act didn't quite disappoint her.
It also felt like a big release, like, we didn't actually have to shape our entire strategy and in some ways our entire identity around this particular bill. You know, every year, for example, we had like a little theme for what our Coming Out of the Shadows rally was going to be. So like the first year was like undocumented and afraid. The second year was documented unafraid and unapologetic. And the third year was after the failure of the Dream Act, and the theme was, I define myself. And it was because we were coming out of like just this very rigid messaging that was about our stories too, and about who got to tell their stories.
In March of this year, the House of Representatives passed the American Dream and Promise Act of 2021. The bill has yet to be voted on by the Senate. And so here we are, 20 years later, frustrated. The issue of immigration, refugees, migrants, people moving, completely unresolved. What September 11th did was to create a narrative that now we've had to be fighting against for 20 years, that somehow immigrants and refugees are a problem. And now we have refugees from Afghanistan, a direct result of September 11th and the actions of the United States government. The people of the United States and the people of Afghanistan and all migrants deserve better than this being the lesson of September 11th. This episode was produced by Alejandra Salazar, Julieta Martinelli, and Victoria Estrada, with help from Reinaldo Leaños Jr., Maria Esquinca, and Oscar de León. It was edited by Andrea López Cruzado and mixed by Elisheba Itu and Gabriela Baez. The Latino USA team includes Marta Martinez, Mike Sargent, Ginny Montalvo, Patricia Zurbarán, and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our editorial director is Julio Ricardo Varela. Our supervising senior engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Our assistant senior engineer is Julia Caruso. Additional engineering by Leah Shaw Damron, with help from JJ Kerubin. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. In the meantime, be thankful for being alive. Remember those who passed, and let's build a better place to live for all of us. And I'll see you on our social media. Ciao.
Funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, New York Women's Foundation. The New York Women's Foundation, funding women leaders that build solutions in their communities, and celebrating 30 years of radical generosity. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Yesterday, the vice president met with some undocumented folks. And a couple of weeks ago, she just told people not to come here. Like, what is the tea?